What the hell is this?
Get up.
Get off my lawn.
Listen, old man, you don't want to fuck with me.
Did you hear me? I said get off my lawn now.
Are you fucking crazy? Go back in the house.
Yeah, I blow a hole in your face and then I go in the house. And I sleep like a baby. You can count on that. We used to stack fucks like you 5 feet high in Korea. Use you for sandbags.
Okay. But you better watch your back.
It's clear. Come on.
Come on.
Thank you.
I know what you're thinking, Bunk. You're thinking, did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Now, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and will blow your head clean off. You could ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker in North Central Indiana on a drizzly, dim, cloudy day, man. I'm not going to the beach today. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your shekels and your moolah. And we'll make sure that we get it distributed in the right places. College education on the race issue. Everything you ever want to know about it is up there, including all the books you can download. And we got a whole big library up there just waiting for you. And the cartoons and all that stuff. Yeah, those cartoons are getting spread all over the world. They've been going around the world many times, and I'll tell you, that cartoonitis got too bad. So anyhow, email address, but I don't think he wants really a whole bunch of people contacting him. I'm sorry about that. If he ever gives me permission, I'll give you his email address and you can talk to him. Well, it's Saturn's day again. Yeah, it's December the 13th, 2014. Saturn's day. How about that? I went to see that film, Interstellar last night. I wasn't going to go see it, but we didn't have anything else that we were excited about. Well, let's go see it, because somebody had given me some, I don't know, they gave me a bum steer on the movie, and which the movie was very good, a very good movie, and get you thinking about a lot of things. And so I would say that it's well worth going to see. Yeah, they show how the earth was being destroyed and agriculture and everything, and they had to look around out of space, see if they could find something. The only thing I disagree with is you know, they were putting billions, and we put billions and billions and billions and more billions of dollars, and of course now we've almost run out of the paper print ink and paper. But I think that, and some people might say, well, you're a crazy son of a bitch, Metzger. Well, I'm saying that I think we should concentrate on developing mind travel, not physical travel into outer space or any place else. I personally believe that we've been around this thing several times before and wiped ourselves out and came back. I think that at one time we probably had the ability to transmit our thoughts to other people. I mean, actually, really clearly. We can do a little bit of that now, but I think we used to have many thousands of years ago, I think we had the ability to communicate clearly with someone, because actually speech, as I've told you before, is a very poor way of communication, for the reason is that you've got pictures in your mind and you want to convey the thought to somebody else. So you convert the picture to speech, and then the person receives it in speech, and they have to convert it back to pictures. And in doing that, a hell of a lot of meaning is lost. But I think if they put as much money into the study of the mind travel as they do in physical space travel, we'd really have something. I mean, there are people doing it now, as far as that's concerned. Some people argue that they're not doing much, and other people say they're doing a lot with remote viewing. So that's right down that alley. I know, according to the information, the CIA and other people have been using that for a long time. And there's a lot of private people, too, using it for oil and gas discovery alongside dowsing and so forth. So we're playing around with it, but we really haven't put a lot of money and concentrated on it. So anyhow, that's what I was thinking about while I was watching the movie. All this hardware and the giant rockets and all the expenditure and that it takes when... Why not travel with your mind? What do you think? Last week I talked to you about my opinion of the racial setup compared to a pyramid, with the genius of the race at the peak and a wide base of population to furnish genetic material, and which leads to the genius. And I say that as the base of the pyramid narrows, and the population of white population becomes less and less, then the genius area at the top of the pyramid slacks off and could disappear. I think when you look at the Negro race, the nigger race, what we're looking at there is they can get up to the stage of mulatto, which is sort of like a pyramid with a wide base, but it's rounded instead of peaked at the top. Yeah, that's the way I look at it, more like a mound, and nature limiting the black race to any possibility of achieving white, Aryan, or whatever you want to call it, superiority. The only way they can do it partially is through gene hijacking, which they're doing a lot today, but you'll see that the mulatto race is unstable. That's why this president cannot make decisions. He cannot. He's all over the board, and now everybody recognizes that because he's a mulatto, and that's the state of the mulatto. They can be very clever, very sharp, but they're unstable, you know, like... others of the mulatto race. I was listening to a couple of experts talk about the history yesterday on the radio. I was driving along, and they were from some big university or something, and they were talking about the Alien Sedition Act that was passed under the Madison administration. I believe he allegedly wrote it up. And they were talking about it and how there was a lot of consternation, and just a lot of people wanted to rise up and do something about that. But they didn't come down to why he developed the Sedition Act. Well, it was because that the French had all these plantations down in Haiti, and the mulattoes were smarter than, of course, most of the pure blacks, even though they were unstable. Well, anyhow, they rose up and cut the throats of all these Frenchmen, and thousands of white Frenchmen fled Haiti. And where did they come? They came right up to Boston. And there was a fear among the public that if it didn't watch out, there'd be a takeover. And I believe it was the time of Napoleon that the French would take back the new colonies. And so that's why Madison came up with this Alien and Sedition Act. And here again, there's niggers at the base of the problem. If there had not been a slave uprising in Haiti and French ran for their lives and came up to Boston, we wouldn't have gone through all that big strife of is it good or is it bad, and Madison and all the boys wouldn't have had to fight so much with each other. So anyhow, if you look around in history, you'll find a hell of a lot of our problems obviously start with greed, but also the black race has something down the line that has something to do with it. And many times, and that's probably why these professors didn't talk about it, because they didn't want to hurt the feelings of the blacks, that it was because of the blacks that the Frenchmen had to take off. Well, anyhow, they're still paying, Haiti's still paying money to the French, believe it or not, after all these years, for this slave uprising that took place in Haiti. Before we get to Sling Blade this morning, I'm going to pursue another tributary of this river of history. And it's something that I received this book. In fact, I received a whole case of them about 25 or 30 years ago. And I read the book, and we talked about it with various people, but they discounted it, especially people who are really into the Hitler worship, which they'll deny, but they do. This was a book written about Hitler. It's called Hitler, the Founder of Israel. And the older I get and the more I look into some of the more evidence, I begin to think the guy was more right than wrong. So we're going to go into it at the... Whoa. At the car. Whoa, that chick. Get that chicken out of here. Well, now that I got the hee-haw chicken out of the bunker, we can proceed here. You never know what's going to happen around here, boys and girls. Well, wait a minute here. Let me get my specs on. I want to read this foreword or introduction to this book, Adolf Hitler, the Father of Israel. And then we'll go into Sling Blade's show. In 1973, on an Atlantic island, the author ran across a staff officer with whom, and together with other men from a dozen of European nations, he besieged Leningrad some 30 years earlier. At the outbreak of the First World War, his parents, Jews of Vienna, while on an oceanic voyage, were impounded and later settled on this island. After first a few drinks in a casino have loosened their tongues, the author asked him, "Amigo, being a full Jew, how can you wear these three medals and decorations with the swastika on your chest?" "Well," came back the answer in a beautiful Viennese jargon, quote, "why don't you start scratching on Hitler yourself? Then you will see that a Vienna Jew like me will appear," unquote. When a small Italian freighter came over 2 weeks later, the author stepped on land in Buenos Aires. Out of a million Jews residing in that city, he spoke at the lunch table or in the cafeteria with many, and at one evening, a drink in the region of Chaco. He heard from a so-called war criminal a similar sigh, quote, Hitler, an Austrian mixed Jew. Oh, dear Lord, after all, the Eichmann of Linz, who has been caught here, was a pure Jew. Finally, after an anti-Zionist and a very educated Jewish lady in the Andes threw herself into a rage, quote, and this Ben-Gurion is Hitler's segundo, the second Hitler. The traveling author decided really to scratch on Hitler and answer the pervasive question, quote, is there any connection between Hitler's unclear origins and the foundations of the State of Israel, which did not exist for 2,000 years? And suddenly, 3 years after Hitler's death, came into being again. One must believe very strongly in the ability to wipe vigorously such a question off the table, like Maser, a German pastor known as a celebrated researcher of Hitler's persona. All the ancestors of this very unique individual in the world's history, a concentration of cunningness, energy, and intelligence, have been derived from old-fashioned circles, which were deeply rooted in the Austrian forest with nothing else in between. The uncertain black spot in the life of his born-out-of-wedlock Jewish grandfather, Frankenberger, was cleared for sure by three illiterate men, Ramader, Breitnieder, and Pilke, and by a document signed with three X marks, but without the required signature of a very careful village pastor. And did not Hitler, after he became Führer, explain to his legal advisor, Hans Frank, a son of a Bamberg Jewish lawyer, that he learned from his grandmother, Schickelgruber, that her son, Alois, Hitler's father, without any doubt originated from an affair between the Jew Frankenberger? Why then, for 14 years, Frankenberger paid faithfully for the support of the born-out-of-wedlock Alois, Hitler's father? Noticeably, in this Hitler story about his grandmother is the fact that Madame Schickelgruber died many years before he was born. Maser, who is certain that the last word about Germany's leader has not yet been said, comes to the conclusion, quote, since the end of the great victories in the snows of Moscow and the simultaneous entry of the U.S. into the war, Hitler knew that the only reason he ordered people to fight and die was to prolong his decision of committing suicide. It was far from it. Exactly at the moment, the war turned into a two-front campaign, therefore he was going to lose. And he was, well, I'll say this, some of his top advisors told him that. I forget the one guy was he was an adversary early on and for the position Hitler took in the German government. And then he was made ambassador to Turkey. And he was quoted from Turkey of saying, the minute they opened a two-front war, it was over. Then Hitler called his most trustful chief of police, Reinhard Tristan Eugene Heydrich. Heydrich's father name was Seuss, and SS Chief Himmler claimed that Seuss had overcome the Jew within himself and sanctioned him to finally solve the Jewish question, for one should realize that only by the destruction of the Jews, an old dream of creation of a home place for the Jewish nation a few years later could come true. 1 year later, a new expert on Hitler, Mr. Fess, strongly contradicted Mr. Maser's research results. Quote, obviously Maser cannot defend his thesis, although he presents it as evidence. Anyway, all his arguments are doubtful in a similar way, unquote. After such a quite correct statement for Mr. Fest, the complex matter suddenly became simple. Quote, in this context, the question of Hitler's grandfatherhood is actually of secondary rank, unquote. For the researcher Fest, from that moment on, the entire question of Hitler's Jewish origin is a subject of subordinate interest. let us protest now impartially is a very bad form of devaluation of any research work. Anyone who does not want to know in detail about Hitler's half-Jewish alcoholic father, whom he dragged home from the ugly, shameful, stinky, and smoky bars, and who does not want to know about Hitler's endlessly psychotic hatred towards his kinsmen, will understand little about history of the 20th century, about the creation of the State of Israel, and about the oncoming events which will make us hold our breaths until the end of this century. The unloved and probably hated father and born out of wedlock grandfather are the two main figures necessary to properly understand this Adolf Hitler. Hitler's experience with Jews in Vienna as being mostly noted in the First World War and during the Soviet Munich for him are undesirable attestations and details of dirt, too. After 1.5 centuries, it is very unlikely for anyone to be able to prove that Jew Frankenberger was Hitler's grandfather on his father's side. However, it is certain that Hitler knew about the child support paid by Frankenberger, and the fear that Frankenberger could have been his grandfather never left him. This fear dominated all his life and undoubtedly motivated his actions. Unlike other historians, the author does not overestimate preserved documents of the defense services or other offices. Between 1933 and 1945, various entities put away or suppressed many documents or created false ones for misleading purposes. In his healthy state of mind, the author evaluated personal impressions and memories of credible witnesses, even if they were of old age, Jewish, or so-called war criminals. The reader will find all this confirmed in the content of the author's investigation, bibliographical index, the most suppressed and bought out or destroyed books, besides making up his own mind, is witnessing all the past events with full credibility. Once a New York judge became very angry at the end of a long-lasting trial, quote, "I can do without your thank you, your honor," unquote, yelling at the just acquitted woman. In the evidence in this case, there is only one missing piece which would convict you, you damned husband murderer, unquote. The author is not, however, of this type of diligence. Before 1933, much was written in the country as well as abroad about Hitler's probable Jewish origin and his close connections with the half-bred Jews of the opposite sex were a subject of fun and joyful criticism. However, after his assumption of power, the country people became cautious and those abroad more distinguished. After 1945, the re-educators of the German people were not inclined to talk about Jews' participation in the Jewish misfortune. As to the treatment of Hitler's Vienna youthful dream of making the Jewish state of Israel out of Arabic Palestine and Jews free of Jews, with Jewish full or partial participation in their misfortune, both sides have the entire matter internationally hushed up. Hence, the old Nazi and the young Zionist could be called Nazionists. There is no doubt that Hitler wasn't a National Socialist. However, his lofty idea, which derived from the graves of the First World War, betrayed him, and with the help of an inborn sophistry, made him a servant to his hatred of his kinsmen and Jewish complexes. The ideology of National Socialism isn't and doesn't have to be anti-Jewish. This was proven in 1973 by the Argentina's experience. Perón, who was called by his people back to power, loudly said what he was about, and his shirted thugs painted on the walls Socialismo Nacional, and his most important prime minister of economy, Burr Gelbard, tried to pull out the state's cart driven by the military with the public enemy swamp. Gelbard was a Jew born in Poland. The unfortunate encounter of Hitler's psychotic hatred towards his kinsmen and the Jewish led Soviet dictatorship of Munich right after the First World War formed out of the National Socialism in Germany, an ideological variation of racism. For the destruction of Jews' existence, as it occurred in reality, it was difficult to find effective helpers who were not of Jewish origin. In the East, three officials were at hand. They were partly Jewish, if not predominantly Jewish: Heydrich, Frank, and Rosenberg. Pictures of the three main criminals, Hitler, Heydrich, and Eichmann, with their unobjectionable Semitic eyes, nose, and mouths, were presented for the author's scrutiny. They consciously or unwillingly participated in the foundation of Israel. At the time these pictures were taken, they were matured in their 40s. At the beer, and first one said to the second, quote, "As the leader of the party and of the German Reich, I will give you, my lovely friend Heydrich, the second German after me, the biggest honor. I will give you the German order of highest degree," unquote. The reader might look unsuccessfully for a book which long ago disappeared from the market. It was extraordinary and instructive investigation conducted by a German Jew, Dietrich Bronder, a high school teacher. Its title was Before Hitler Came. It was printed in 1964 and is about who was and who in Hitler's apparatus of Jewish descent or being related to Jewish families. The leader of the Reich's Chancellor, Adolf Hitler, his representatives, the Reich's Minister, Rudolf Hess, the Reich's Marshal, Hermann Göring, the Reich's leader of the NSDAP, Gregor Strasser, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, Alfred Rosenberg, Hans Frank, Heinrich Himmler, and Reich's Minister von Ribbentrop, who pledged close friendship to the famous Zionist Chaim Weizmann, the first head of the State of Israel, who died in 52, von Kudel, field commanders, Globnik, the Jewish destructor, Jordan and Wilhelm Hube, the great SS leaders Reinhard Heydrich, Erich von dem Bock-Zelewski, and von Kudel II, who also were active in the destruction of the Jews. Next came Hitler's bankers before 1933, supporters Ritter von Strauss, vice president of the NS Parliament, von Stein, the general field marshal, and Secretary of State Milch, and the Undersecretary of State Gauss, the physicists and old party members Philip von Lenhard and Abraham Esau, the very old party member Hans Stegel, NSDAP's newspaper chief of Foreign Department, later on an advisor to President D.E. Roosevelt, as well as Professor Haushofer. All of them were members of the Secret Thule Order Society. This list is not complete. If you devote a little time, these findings of relations between Hitler's sick hatred towards his kinsmen, with this henchman on one side and the creation of a State of Israel on the other, then you should satisfy your curiosity. Nevertheless, the author, as well as the publisher, will be thankful for any new evidence that might emerge. Like I say, shortly after this was printed, I was approached by a man from San Diego who was his exact situation I never found out, but he gave me a case of these books, and like I say, on and off I picked a book up, and sometimes I was real negative on it, sometimes I was positive, but as I'm collecting more and more evidence on what was going on, I'm becoming more inclined to believe that this book, Hitler, the Father of Israel, is for the most part quite true. So anyhow, that's the introduction, and this next week we'll start on the inside and trace Hitler's origins. So that's it. Now we're going to go to Sling Blade. And like I've said before, these are old shows out of the archives. I don't know exactly what the dates are on some of them, and so anyhow, some of the phone numbers and references to other people are past due history. So anyhow, take that the way I'm giving it to you. Here we go.
Into some very interesting times. And it's not going to be pretty. I don't say that for shock effect. I really believe there's going to be some serious brutality coming the white race's way. I am convinced of it. You know, you got Michelle Obama talking before the NAACP the other day. Now here she is. She's reached the highest pinnacle of American society. She's the first lady of the goddamn country. And she's still harping about inequality in America. And complaining that, you know, the black child's more likely to be a resident than a white child. These people are showing themselves for who they really were. You guys know that, but the dumbed-down white masses out there don't know it. And why blacks are getting more and more militant, because I guess they really believed that white people would just continue to fawn all over Obama. And black people cannot stand to hear anyone talk negative about Obama. It's automatically construed as racism. You know, they never want to, you know, it's okay for when they criticize Bush, and rightfully so, and Clinton and everyone else, but now we got a black president. Black people are very offended if you talk bad about Obama. This is the type of primitive type of people that we're dealing with, and they're in our society by the millions. We didn't see the inherent danger 100 years ago or 200 years ago. We could have done something about it then. Now, there's going to come a day where they are running amok all over America, just slaughtering white people. That's going to happen. It's a fucking guarantee. It is going to happen. Try to tell white people what's coming, and they don't want to hear it. Instead, you got soccer moms in the suburbs raising their white kids, especially white boys, to be little sissies. You can always tell a white kid who comes from the suburbs and comes from a middle-class home and one who doesn't. They don't even got to open up their mouth. It's just the way they carry themselves. You can tell by their swagger. So it behooves all of us to be ready physically and mentally for what's coming. How can you physically get ready besides, I mean, I've talked about it before over and over again. We need to be training in martial arts. I mean, real martial arts, not Taekwondo or Hapkido. If you've been in Taekwondo or Hapkido for a year and you try that shit out in the street, you're probably going to get pummeled. Search for real martial combat type of training. Kempo's not bad. Jeet Kune Do's pretty good. Krav Maga's pretty good. Okay? Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is good. I mean, it'll get you in shape. I mean, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu practitioners are in phenomenal shape. You know, they have just outstanding cardiovascular, stamina. The only problem is when you go for an armbar or a leg lock on the street, your opponent's partners could be playing World Cup soccer with your head. You can't be doing no fancy joint locks on the street. You got to dispatch your enemy quickly. That's why you need to become proficient in knife fighting, stick fighting. You got to know how to handle weapons. Even weapons that go boom. But one aspect of getting physically ready is we got to start looking after the diet. We need to stay away from the four white poisons: salt, sugar, and bleached out white flour. With the exception of salt, the reason why sugar is white and flour is white is because all the nutrients have been taken out of it. You know, if you had a piece of sugar cane and you eat that and drink the juice or whatever, that's a little bit healthy for you because you still have the fiber and the protein in it. But when they refine sugar cane, the molasses, which is dark brown, still has some nutrients in it. And then you refine that further to brown sugar, still has... I would still stay away from brown sugar even. And then the further refinement of that is white sugar. I'm going to read a personal story here from this Sugar Blues, and I'm going to let it alone. He says, one night, in one sitting, I read a little book that said, very simply, if you're sick, it's your own damn fault. Pain is the final warning. You know better than anyone else how you've been abusing your body, so stop it. Sugar is poison, it said, from more lethal than opium and more dangerous than atomic fallout. Shades of Gloria Swanson in The Sugar Cube. She had a brief encounter with Gloria Swanson. I guess she was a physical fitness guru in the early 70s, and, you know, she was one that was warning about sugar. Hadn't she told me everyone has to find out for themselves the hard way? I had nothing to lose but my pains. I began the next morning with firm resolve. I threw all the sugar out of my kitchen. Then I threw out everything that had sugar in it, cereals and canned fruit, soups and bread. Since I had never really read any labels carefully, I was shocked to find that shelves were soon empty. So was the refrigerator. I began eating nothing but whole grains and vegetables. What does this sound like to you? If you guys are familiar with Matt Hale and who's the guy who wrote The White Man's Bible? Oh, Ben Klassen. That's salubrious living. Ben Klassen, I mean, he lived by that. He was a strict disciplinarian. I don't know if Resist.com still got that radio show where Matt Hale's talking about salubrious living. You go through a real withdrawal. You may even get sick. When you're getting sick because your body is detoxifying. And he said he lost all this weight and whatever. And then when all that passed, he started putting on quality weight, you know. Weight not from cupcake, but weight from, like, broccoli and carrots and stuff like that. Listen, I'm not saying you got to, you know, live like a caveman, eat only nuts and fruit and this and that. If you get rid of all your soda pop, stay away from soda pop, energy drinks, Monsters, Monster energy drink, that was my demon of vice. Did I mention ketchup, ice cream, cake, candy? Stay away from all pastries, all candy, all pies, you know? You know, if you're at a family get-together and it's been like 8 months since you had any sweets and somebody serves you a piece of apple pie, you know, it's not going to kill you if you eat it, but don't let that take you back down the road. And believe me, I've met plenty of people in the struggle who are fat and portly, and at the two Hitler celebrations I'm thinking about, boy, they bamboozled that, or they just bum rushed at the pastry cart. You know, they just went to town on that stuff. Don't be like that. Okay? Alright, so I began eating nothing but whole grains and vegetables. In about 48 hours, I was in total agony, overcome with nausea, with a crashing migraine. If pain was a message, this was a long one. Very involved, intense, but in code. It took hours to break the code. I knew enough about junkies to recognize reluctantly my kinship with them. I was kicking sugar cold turkey, the thing they talked about with such terror. After all, heroin is nothing but a chemical. They take the juice of the poppy, and then they refine it into opium, and then they refine it into morphine, and then finally the heroin. Sugar is nothing but a chemical. They take the juice of the cane or the sugar beet, they refine it to molasses, and then they refine it to brown sugar, and then finally to strange white crystals, which numerous doctors say is like ground-up glass going through your system. It's no wonder dope pushers dilute more heroin with milk sugar lactose, in order to make their glassine packages a treat to the eye. I was kicking all kinds of chemicals cold turkey, sugar, aspirin, cocaine, caffeine, chlorine, fluorine, sodium, monosodium glutamate. That stuff is not good for you. MSG, it's in everything. I mean, you gotta, you know, it's in your, they put it in a lot of soups as a, I guess, a protein substitute for meat or as an additive. But it messes up some people's insides. What it does, it gets in your system and it keeps your body from absorbing the nutrients of other food. So if you're having intestinal problems after you eat certain foods, it could be because of monosodium glutamate. So, or it don't have to be monosodium. It could be just glutamate. Gluten-free is the way to go. And all those other multisyllabic horrors listed in fine print on the tins and boxes I had just thrown in the trash. I had it very rough for about 24 hours. But the morning after was a revelation. I went to sleep with exhaustion, sweating, and tremors. I woke up feeling reborn. Grains and vegetables tasted like a gift from heaven. The next few days brought a succession of wonders. My rear stopped bleeding. He talked about earlier in the book how he had bleeding hemorrhoids. So did my gums. My gums stopped bleeding. My skin began to clear up, and I had a totally different texture when I washed. I discovered bones in my hands and feet that had been buried under bloat. I bounced out of bed at strange hours in the morning, raring to go. My head seemed to be working again. I had no problems anymore. I had no difficulty concentrating on any task. My shirts were too big. So were my shoes. One morning while shaving, I discovered I had a jaw. To make a long, happy story short, I dropped from 205 to a neat 135 in 5 months and ended up with a new body, a new head, and a new life. Now, 135 pounds, I hope this guy's like 5'5 or 5'4. At 5'10, I don't want to be 135 pounds. No way. One day I burned my Blue Cross card, and about that time I noticed a picture of Gloria Swanson in the New York Times, and I sat down and wrote her a letter. Today when I see someone unpeeling a sugar cube, I twitch as I remember Gloria Swanson twitching at that lunchtime press conference. I yearn to collar them in a quiet corner and tell them how easy it is to lose the sugar blues. Consider yourself collared. What if you have to lose? The sugar blues. So, goes on to say that this guy hasn't seen a doctor or hospital to taking a pill or an aspirin in well over 15 years because of his diet. Well, let us all strive to be, you know, specimens of the best health we can, because we're going to need it. We don't want to be overweight and arthritic with a bunch of health problems when we're possibly fighting for our lives. If you think I'm over-dramatizing things, I mean, I'm a student of history. And what's coming is not going to be pretty. In fact, it's going to be worse than anything experienced anywhere else in the world, because it's going to be based on race. Black people have an instinctual, unrepressible hatred for white people. Even black people who have a bunch of white friends. You know, like everyone else, they know how to be polite and politically correct and smile at you and this and that and, you know, be the typical people pleasers that all races deal with that. It's a herd thing. But they have an implacable hatred for us. They don't want to look at the fact that there are more rich black people east of the Mississippi in the United States alone than there are all over the world combined. There are more rich black people in the eastern part of the United States than all of Africa alone. They don't care. They have a very primitive way of thinking. They feel like they should be, you know, treated like gods, like gods on Mount Olympus or something. They really do. Feel like they should have the respect given to somebody who's done something great. Barack Obama has not done anything great. And that is a fact. Well, for the rest of this tape, I want to use up, because this is a package of 10 I got from Metzger, and this is the last show, the season finale. I'm not going to do any more Ghost Wolf shows for a number of months. But like I said, I will co-host with Metzger. Tommy Metz. Gurr. All right, let's look at weapons and terrorism here out of the Handbook for Outlaws and Rebels. It says here, destroy a home. Terrorists sometimes target the natural gas utility. A gas leak has a built-in timer. The gas must first saturate the air, and a built-in ignition system is the pilot light of any gas appliance. Going down further, it says, today trucks and vans carry an explosive equivalent of a B-24 heavy bomber of World War II. The vehicle is a semi-tractor trailer size and can carry the equivalent of 60 tons of TNT. Terrorists, and this is what weapons of mass destruction, especially those interested in mega-terrorism, use weapons of mass destruction. One terrorist scenario described by Ken Alabek involves a human biological weapon. A terrorist inoculated against a specific form of infection, such as smallpox, carries a sample of the agent onto a plane headed to New York, Paris, or Moscow. In the flight, the crew and the passengers have become affected. Infected can then disperse throughout the city and then depart for other cities. Before even noticed symptoms, since the smallpox virus has an incubation period of 2 weeks, millions will become infected before the world realizes it had been attacked. Well, that's the wonders of having open borders. Great. Atrocities in war. All war produces atrocities. In Liberia's Civil War, in which two-thirds of the rebel fighters were aged 12 to 17 years, there were reports of rape, blood drinking, and cannibalism. Young soldiers placed wagers on the genders of the fetuses inside pregnant women and then ripped open the women to see who won. That's great. Typical black behavior. I don't know if there's any reports of white people doing that in history. I'd like to know about it. The conduct of war is determined by two factors: the nature of the weapons available and the modes of transportation. Under cost of war, when the ancient Roman army was not fighting, it was building. In the modern era, however, many armies are unproductive. According to historian Lewis Mumford, an army is a body of pure consumers. In one period, the year between 1948 and 2003, the U.S. spent $15 trillion on the military. That was more than the accumulated man-made wealth in the United States at that time. The value of all factories, homes, schools, hospitals, bridges, roads, and so forth combined. Military weapons are the ultimate capitalist products. They destroy other products. They can typically be used only once, and their high cost yields large profits. And who those large profits go to? Military industrial complex, some transnational corporations, but most of all the banks. Crimes and war. When the Black Prince of England captured King John of France at the Battle of Poitiers in 1356, he treated the king honorably and honored John in Windsor Castle. After World War II, however, when the Japanese lost what they called the Holy War for the liberation of billions of Asians, many of their leaders were given a mock trial followed by a hanging. Today, war criminals who win a war inflict harsh punishments on those who lose. Well, it wasn't always like that. I mean, even in Waterloo, when Wellington beat Napoleon, Napoleon's army was at least allowed to march off the field of battle with their arms and with their honor. Lethality of war. The population of Earth was 200 million during the time of Christ. During the 20th century alone, wars have killed 100 million men, women, and children. Modern wars, extreme examples of strategic crime, are exceptionally deadly. Nearly 80% of all males born in USSR, 80% of all males born in USSR in 1923 did not survive World War II. Wow. Boy, I guess the Jew really got his wish on that, huh? Think of all the millions of Russians that have died over the last 100 years because of bullshit. Madness of war. In 1968, after annihilating a hamlet called Ben Tray, an American military officer commented, "It was necessary to destroy the village in order to save it." Curiously, in World War II, the United States, in order to save democracy, ended up taking measures that ruined democracy, such as the introduction of spying, official secrets, conscription, exorbitant taxation, and censorship. Sound like hypocrisy to me. Modern war. Whatever its lethality, modern war brings glory, power, and wealth to a small elite. Of the 164 men in the West Point Academy class of 1915, 61 of those ended up as generals, 2 with 5 stars, 2 with 4 stars, 7 with 3 stars, 50 with 2 stars, and 1 with 1 star. After Douglas MacArthur had lost the Philippines and had fled to Australia, he was given the Medal of Honor. Appropriately, he was given a coveted award on April Fool's Day. Even more bizarre was the career of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who began World War II as a lieutenant colonel. By June 1942, Eisenhower was the commander of the Allied European Theater, even though he had never experienced hostile gunfire. By 1953, Eisenhower was the president of the United States. You know, this whole thing with Eisenhower, I really see Jewish machination behind the whole thing. In fact, I heard that Eisenhower was a Swedish Jew, or related to a Swedish Jew. But there were a lot more qualified people in the European theater than this guy. I mean, you talk about someone who's manufactured. You know, now he did leave office warning about the military-industrial complex. But it's just something that seems very manufactured about the whole career of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Okay. Opposition to war. While a war is being fought, opposition can be perilous. During both world wars and all the countries involved, those who were openly questioned the legitimacy of the conflicts were ignored, scorned, ostracized, hounded, interned, and sometimes executed. In the United States, no one has ever been punished for warmongering, but anti-war protesters are routinely sanctioned. Interesting, an anti-war or peace movement has worked only once in American history. It stopped the war against Vietnam. No, it didn't. What are you talking about there, buddy? That's not true. But he does make a good point that during war, the people who go to jail are the anti-war people. All right. Waging war. Like establishing colonies impoverishes a nation, but it fantastically enriches a small elite. According to historian Lewis Mumford, usurious oligarchies finance a ruler's mischievous policies of war and then live sumptuously on the profits and loot. The masses, meanwhile, pay the taxes and sacrifice their lives. In World War I, for example, common soldiers were paid $30 a month. And from that small amount, they had to pay $6 a month for insurance policy. Meanwhile, according to Smedley Butler, the same war produced at least 22,000 new American millionaires and billionaires. And that number does not include the profiteers who falsified their tax returns. Psychological war. Psychological war, the term was coined by the Nazis in 1941, is war against the mind. In the Algerian War, 1954 to 1962, the French used psychological weapons divided into two types. Psychological war directed against the enemy to undermine his will to resist, and psychological action directed against the population and the French security forces to strengthen morale and allegiance and fighting will. The French called their two techniques destruction and construction. Destruction and construction. Rules of war. A series of international agreements, most dating from 1959 and 1907, distinguishes war from mere crime. According to these rules, only official violence on behalf of the state is allowed. Soldiers must fight only in uniform, they must carry their arms openly, and they must obey a commander responsible for them. Also, soldiers must not violate truces or take up arms if captured. Civilians must be left alone, and in return, civilians are not supposed to meddle with war. The rules of war, although meritorious, are often irrational. However, thus, dum-dum bullets are forbidden by the rules of war, but thermonuclear bombs are not. Stupidity of war. War is imbecilic on many levels. In the Battle of the Somme, a manic bloodbath in World War I, 1,200,000 men were killed on both sides and nothing was achieved. In the American Civil War, a destructive and ruinous conflict, one economic historian has calculated that money squandered by both sides had been sufficient to purchase the freedom of all the slaves and provide them with free land and pay them 100 years of back wages. So who got rich off that war? If they could have done that with all that money, then why have the war? Well, that's because slavery was a subsidiary issue of the Civil War. The war was about economics. In Vietnam, the U.S. intervened militarily, even though no Vietnamese soldier or guerrilla had destroyed American property or injured an American. The U.S. thought that the war was important to its security, even though Washington, D.C. is closer to the South Pole than to Hanoi. In 1969, the world witnessed a so-called soccer war. A border dispute turned into a war when El Salvador's soccer team scored a last-minute winning goal against neighboring Honduras in the World Cup. A war began within hours. A struggle would claim 3,000 dead and 6,000 injured. Yeah, that's pretty fucking stupid. On rare occasions, however, rationality can prevail. In the year 1078, in the Siege of Seville, King Alfonso VI prepared a siege to expel the Moors when the Moorish ruler Al-Mu'tamid heard that Alfonso was a chess enthusiast. He sent his chess champion, Ibn Ammar to play the king for possession of the city. Ibn Ammar won the contest, and the Castilians, true to their word, withdrew. That was when they were trying to get the Moors out of Spain, I guess. That's kind of a cool story. I wish the Moor would have lost. But anyways, what's done is done. According to Major H. von Dach, if you remember, I did a number of Ghost Wolf shows about H. von Dach. Major H. von Dach, Swiss resistance tactician. I think the shows were called Guerrilla Radio then. But the author of Total Resistance, regular armies are supplied by factories, warehouses, and depots. Guerrilla units, however, live on the war and must steal everything they need. By World War II, an armored division consumed 100,000 gallons of gasoline daily. And as the Nazis discovered in the USSR, the further an attacker advances, his supply problems grow greater. His forces become weaker, and the environment becomes more hostile. Interesting. Under technology of war, let me go ahead in this story here, save on reading. At the Battle of Omdurman in 1898, for example, the British under General Horatio Kirchner used machine guns against the Sudanese. The British lost only 43 men while destroying an army of 52,000 Sudanese. The British fired 500,000 rounds of ammunition. Against a clever foe, however, technology is less effective. In the case of the American-Vietnamese War, light infantry without air power, usually with no artillery support larger than mortars, defeated the United States in the most technically advanced empire in history. Regarding military technology, this general rule applies. The simpler the environment, the more effective the technology. Thus, high technology weapons are most effective in featureless environments, such as in the air or at sea or in desert landscapes. They are less effective in complex environments, such as built-up urban areas. Interesting. You guys find that interesting? Air power. Cities and weapons. Avoid cities during air wars. Not only do towns draw attacks, the bombs can cause more danger in an urban setting. Collapsing structures, flying debris, increase the hazard. If you must remain in an urban area during an air war, a crowbar is an essential item. If buried alive in rubble, use a crowbar to tap messages to rescuers. Also, the crowbar can be used to dig through walls to adjoining rooms or even adjoining buildings. The urban dweller must keep water, rags, and sand around the house. During bombings, moisten the rags and breathe through them when running through flames. First, wrap yourself in wet rags. Use the water and the sand to control flames. Let's talk about air power countermeasures used by the Vietnamese under the subject of weapons. During the American-Vietnamese War, the United States dropped 36 tons of bombs for every square mile of both North and South Vietnamese territory. The Vietnamese, however, developed ingenious methods to counter air power. When America attacked their petroleum reserves, for example, the Vietnamese put oil in barrels and scattered the barrels around the country. And when America bombed her villages, the villages waded into the South China Sea up to their necks for safety. When facing air power, the Vietnamese applied these rules. They dispersed their forces and assets. They placed their forces and assets in tunnels and foxholes. Whenever possible, they intermingled their forces with the civilian population. And they mastered the Soviet technique of the close embrace. Regarding the close embrace, as the Battle of Stalingrad, the Red Army was never more than 50 yards from the German soldiers. The idea is that hugging, or the close embrace, makes it difficult for the enemy to employ his air power and artillery without killing his own troops. To neutralize American air assets, the Vietnamese would move extremely close before firing, and they would move even closer when the Americans called in airstrikes. Defense against weapons, air power. To remain invisible to modern aircraft, avoid all targets such as buildings, vehicles, and tanks, and remain motionless. To neutralize infrared detection devices, cover yourself with mud, wrap yourself in space blankets made of aluminum and mylar. Space blankets reflect body heat back toward the body. If caught in the open during an air bomb attack, take refuge in the lowest depression available. This minimizes injury from shrapnel. Also, cover your ears and open your mouth to avoid the effects of concussion. I'm glad he said that because we learned that in the Army. Remember, low-flying aircraft are vulnerable to small arms fire. In Rhodesia, guerrillas fired their automatic weapons ahead of an attacking aircraft, making it fly into a stream of lead. Guerrillas fired 200 yards ahead of the jet aircraft and 50 yards ahead of a helicopter or a propeller-driven planes. Atomic and thermonuclear construction of weapons. If fissile material, highly enriched uranium or plutonium, is available, constructing a bomb is elementary. Indeed, it is theoretically possible to produce a nuclear explosion by dropping two pieces of plutonium onto each other from a suitable height. The Hiroshima bomb of 1945 was a simple and reliable gun-type weapon. It used an anti-aircraft gun barrel that was 6.5 inches wide and 6 feet long and weighed 1,000 pounds. Smokeless powder called cordite used in the conventional artillery fired a 56-pound highly enriched uranium bullet into a target composed of 85 pounds of highly enriched uranium. You get the story. Atomic and thermonuclear defense against weapons. Atomic and thermonuclear bombs can produce four lethal effects: the blast, the heat, the radiation, and radioactive fallout. In addition, the weapons can produce an electromagnetic pulse, which will disable cars, cellular telephones, computers, and so forth. If caught in the open, take cover behind a hill or lie in a ditch with your head away from the blast. Cover all exposed skin. If possible, place a wet towel over your nose and mouth, and do not look at the detonation. Remember that during tests, soldiers in trenches 2,500 yards from ground zero survived. Also, you see a big blast with a mushroom cloud or whatever. You'll see the blast first. You gotta make a conscious effort not to look at that. Because if you look at it for like maybe a second or two, it'll burn your retina out and you'll be blinded for, there we go, it talks about it here. Tragically, if a person happens to be looking in the direction of a nuclear flash, there is no time to blink. The blast burns away the retina and the victim will be blinded forever. Over thousands of square miles, pilots will be blinded. Yeah, that initial blast, I guess, is like the freaking... It's like the sun. It's like as hot as the sun, I guess. The prudent survivalist will wear an eye patch. If a blast occurs and he's caught by surprise, at least he will not be totally blind. In the days of the Cold War, American B-47 bombers were instructed to wear an eye patch in case of a nuclear attack. Stay down until the blast wave passes. Remember, after the detonation, it takes 30 seconds or more for the blast wave to arrive. If you are close enough to see the blast, fallout will arrive in about 20 minutes. 20 minutes? No, I'll take faster than that. 80% of the fallout will arrive in the first 24 hours. If possible, leave the area. Discard your clothes and shower. You cannot leave the area. No fallout shelters available. Place as much distance as possible between you and the radioactive dust. In a building, go to the corner of the basement in a large building. Take refuge in the center of the middle floors. There's a word here. E-Q-U-I, and then distant. Equidistant, whatever that means, from the dust on the roof and from the dust on the floor. All right, so if you're in a urban setting and, you know, the nuclear flash goes off, well, you got a little time to find cover. Or actually, after the blast wave occurs, or you definitely want to, you know, to not be subject to fallout and then sickness, radioactive sickness, radiation sickness. If you're in a large building, be in the middle floor. If you're in a house, be in a corner in one of your basements. Yeah. Elsewhere in the world, individuals will have to build their own shelters. This includes people in the United States. I guess these were popular in the 50s.
All right, I took up too much at the beginning. We're going to have to cut it loose here. And I'll check out and see how much was left on there. If there's not much left, I'll make another MP3 and add it into the show as two separate MP3 files. That was a good show by Sling Blade. And we'll be back with him next Wednesday, I think. Yeah, if the gods are smiling on us, Odin and Thor, all of them, yeah, Freya, yeah, 14 words and 5 words. I have nothing to say, asshole. Wait a minute, that's 6 words. Okay. All right. I want a lawyer. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Concrete. You know, if there would have been an attack in the 50s, I bet there would have been a lot of white people that would have survived. Fallout shelters and supplies. To be effective, a fallout shelter needs to be stocked with water, food, and weapons. The shelter needs at least 2 weeks' supply of water. At a minimum level, the adult requires 2.5 quarts of water per day. For food, the shelter should contain 4 airtight plastic containers filled with wheat, honey, so sugar, I say stay away from sugar, powdered milk, and salt, respectively. A year's supply of these items can be purchased for 1/2 the ounce of gold. Properly stored, the powdered milk will last a long time. The wheat has almost unlimited life shelf, and the sugar and salt will last forever. Stay away from sugar. Get honey instead. The shelter should also include canned food, such as meats, vegetables, soups, and fruit. Supply of multivitamins as a last resort, bags of dried dog food. Dried dog food is cheap and does not spoil, and a 100-pound sack contains as many calories as a ton of potatoes. In defense, I've heard of people eating cat food and dog food to survive, so. In defense, the shelter should contain a shotgun and a small 22 caliber handgun. Note that 500 rounds of 22 caliber ammunition weighs 3.5 pounds and fits inside of a pocket. 500 rounds of 357 Magnum ammunition, in contrast, weighs 35 pounds and requires a briefcase. Why are weapons required? Remember, as one survivalist noted, the homeless, the starving, the nuclear sick, and mobs of survivors will be roaming the countryside looking for two things, food and loot, and someone to blame. Who's that someone to blame? It'll be the middle class. It'll be the white middle class. When the shit hits the fan in this country, it's not going to be the mega rich bankers who are going to be mobbed and tarred and feathered and so forth. It's going to be the white middle class. Somehow, the global elite and these Bilderberg fucks are going to put it in people's heads that it's the white middle class that caused all this. I guarantee you, they're going to be the scapegoat. All right. Defense against biological weapons. Defense against biological weapons. Understand that there are 4 ways of defense to dispense bioweapons. Through the air, contamination of food and water, contact with infected persons or animals, such as rats, birds, and insects. And four, touching objects that have been contaminated. The best defense against biological weapons is isolation. Against smallpox and plague, for example, lock your doors and remain alone. The death rate from smallpox is 30%. And smallpox can be passed through the air to another person. Surgical masks and goggles are useful. And good hygiene is important. The body, as well as anything touching the body, should be thoroughly washed to decontaminate. It is important to have a supply of soap, water, chlorine, bleach, and pure alcohol. For protection, avoid the bodily secretions of others, including their blood, saliva, sexual fluids, and bodily waste. I don't think that even needs printing. I wouldn't want to go near that stuff anyways. Most viruses cannot survive outside the host, but some, like the cold virus, can live long enough to be dangerous. Note that sunlight kills most, but not all, biological agents. So, oh, incident. There is something in Sugar Blues I forgot to read. And I want to make sure I cover this. And if you're bored, well, there's a lot you can do if you're bored. You can, okay. Let's see how much time we have left. All right. The difference between the expensive diseases like cancer and the cheap ones like sugar blues is crucial. Present-day orthodox treatment for cancer is fiendishly expensive. Your financial ruin is your doctor's yacht. The treatment for sugar blues or hypoglycemia is a do-it-yourself proposition. Kick man-refined sugar and say goodbye to doctor and hospital bills. Mink coats for the wives and sunshine seminars in Bermuda can hardly be squeezed from that. By the 1970s, the slogan was preventative medicine. What the disease establishment means by preventative medicine, however, is the regular and costly visits to the MD or clinic or expensive test, and maybe a few sermon on smoking and cholesterol. If Doc can hide his paunch under his white coat and abstain from tobacco long enough to deliver it, plenty of money can be made for this kind of preventative medicine from people terrified of cancer and heart disease. Medicine is only one valid answer for preventing the sugar blues. Let's say again, medicine has only one valid answer for preventing the sugar blues or hypoglycemia or pre-diabetes. Preventative nutrition. Stop eating sugar. Stop before you ruin your adrenal glands, before you end up with the symptoms of the sugar blues, hypoglycemia, pre-diabetic condition, or whatever you want to call it. How much money can anyone charge you for simple advice like that? In 1957, there was an organization called the Health and Education and Welfare Plate. It's called the HEU. HEU data on sugar blues goes unpublished. Because it goes unpublished, the AMA can claim not to know about it. So in 1973, they can notify America with a straight face that claims of hypoglycemia being widespread in this country are not supported by medical evidence. After all, advice is only HEU statistical epidemiological evidence. Whatever. Former patients, misdiagnosed and mistreated, reported the evidence, not the doctors. Therefore, it is not medical evidence. That surely is quite clear. Medical evidence as such does not exist because those 66,000 people in the statistical survey did not have medical records to back up their opinions. They didn't have medical records because most doctors and hospitals still refused to give the patients copies of their diagnosis and test results. The AMA's credibility is based on our ignorance. People also pointed out that the bubonic plague that hit England in the 1600s really just devastated the city, the urban areas. Well, the urban areas, everyone was eating sugar, even the lowest man on the street. And they noticed that people, when sugar was a regular part of their diet, everyone had rotted teeth. Even the royalty dealt with rotted teeth and bleeding gums. But when they went out in the rural areas, when they had the sorceress type of women out there, they didn't have the bubonic plague. Now you can say, well, they didn't come in contact with the city dwellers. That may be true, but also they had better health because they didn't have sugar. Also, there's been some talk about the white man in America running into Native Americans, into these Asiatic Mongols, and they noticed that they had great freaking teeth, perfectly healthy teeth. Why? They didn't have no sugar in their diet. And then word got around to the Indian tribes, you know, when Indian tribes that had contact with the American outposts or whatever, stay away from their white flour, stay away from their white sugar. That stuff wears out the adrenal glands. It wears out your pancreas that has to produce insulin to, I guess, break down the sugar and turn into glucose for the bloodstream. I recommend you guys get a copy of this book, The Sugar Blues, and read it. Sugar is a killer. Now, this is the Ghost Wolf season finale. I may be back by Christmas time. I may not be. It all depends on my schedule. I'm a very hectic, not hectic, it's just unpredictable. I have a very unpredictable lifestyle. You know, this coming weekend, it being July 17th, this Saturday, I'm going to be out of town, out of state. Maybe for a day, maybe for a month. I just don't know. I never know. I kind of, you know, fly by the seat of my pants when it comes to things here. I just use this house in Berwyn to, to basically keep my stuff. When I hit the road and I go to other racialist organizations that I infiltrate under pseudonym names, you know, and I distribute literature about leaderless resistance, and I tell them what they're doing is fucked up. You don't know how many feds can be here right now. I tell them to conduct their racial activities far from home and far from work. And when I say far, I'm not talking about hundreds of miles. 20 miles could be far. You have to make that determination. If you are unknown by the system, you can operate in your own area. But remember, the feds have a thing called geographic profiling. They look at where things happen, and when someone gets on their radar, they look at where they live and where they work, and wear nondescript, uncharacteristic clothing. So we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Carpe noctem. Seize the night.
2 points before I go. And that was on Salubrious Living by Ben Klassen. Well, actually, Ben Klassen, I don't think he'd care now, but that was taken directly from a book, and I've got it in my library someplace. I think the guy's name was Taylor or something like that, who wrote a book like Salubrious Living, in fact, exactly. I don't know when it was, maybe in the 30s or maybe later, but anyhow. Just for a point of view there. Okay, and also Eisenhower, he was chosen over about 30 other officers that were much smarter and much better educated. And the reason he was because Eleanor the bitch Roosevelt insisted there was some kind of a friendly thing between them, and that's how it happened. She encouraged FDR to make David Eisenhower, and yeah, he was known in college as the Swedish Jew. Now, whether that was just a joke they hung on him, I would imagine that would not be one you'd want hung on you. But in his yearbook, it's signed as the Swedish Jew. So anyhow, and his treatment of German POWs after the war leads me to believe he certainly was at least a Jew thinker, because the depravity, and there's a book out on that, I forget now what the title was, but anyhow, it was horrible what happened to the POWs after the war. The war was bad enough, but then after the war, it was in some cases even worse. Sayonara, and 14 words. And 5 words. I have nothing to say. Goodbye, shut up, and bye-bye.